And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting and understandable. I'm John Wells, and I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. I'm also here with Winter Wonderland, as it snowed last night here in the little city. Well, we have a fascinating show for you this morning. Our first guest is Alan Dikaitos, who has written The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shaped the History of Life. Throughout the world, closely related species are found on land masses separated by wide stretches of ocean. But what explains these far-flung distributions? Why are such species found where they are across the Earth? Now, since the discovery of plate tectonics, scientists have conjectured that plants and animals were scattered over the globe by riding pieces of ancient supercontinents as they broke up. Well, this theory is now under fire, and our first guest will tell us why.
And good morning, John Wells. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest will be Jason Silva. Now, this is an interesting guy who's full of energy and brilliance, I might add. He's known as a technology philosopher. He's a TED Global speaker and host of the Brain Games on the National Geographic Channel. The TED conference called Jason a performance philosopher, and others have called him the new Carl Sagan. I've heard him referred to as the new Timothy Leary. It's all for his poetic, impassioned, and inspirational take on scientific and technological advancements. He's got a riveting on-stage delivery style and very enthusiastic insights on creativity, innovation, technology, philosophy, and the human condition. We'll look forward to that conversation with Jason Silva. These two guests, plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio on KPCW, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be back after these messages.
Jan, I just don't know what to do.
John, you're such a flake.
If only there were a show on Friday at 9 a.m. to fill me in on Frosty Weekend Fun.
I thought you knew. Warm up your weekend with Fun Friday.
Find out what to do, who to see, and where to go.
Don't be left out in the cold.
Tune in to Fun Friday for frostbite-free fun. Thanks to our jingly sponsors.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort.
Foothill Oriental Rugs.
Wasatch Pub, Squatter's Pub and Brewery.
And Summit County Business Directory.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Our first guest is Alan Dikaitos, who's written a fascinating book, The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shaped the History of Life. Now, throughout the world, closely related species are found on land masses separated by wide stretches of ocean. How did this happen? Well, since the discovery of plate tectonics, scientists have conjectured that plants and animals were scattered over the globe by riding pieces of ancient supercontinents as they broke up. Well, our next guest has shaken up those theories as the genomic revolution has made reams of new data available. And the data's revealed extraordinary, stranger-than-fiction story. In The Monkey's Voyage, biologist Alan Dikaitos describes the radical new view of how fragmented distributions of life came into being. Alan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah. Alan, let's start with a term that I just learned in the last couple of days, biogeography, where species live and how they got there. How did you get involved in this field?
Well, it really started with a trip that I took about a dozen years ago to Baja, California, to collect some garter snakes. And this was for something that had nothing to do with biogeography. It was for a study on the behavior of these garter snakes. So, but the weird thing about these garter snakes is that they're only found near the tip of Baja, California. And then the rest, the other populations of that same species, are all across the Sea of Cortez in what you might think of as the mainland of Mexico. So that got me thinking, how did that population near the tip of Baja California get there? And that's really what got me into the whole field of biogeography and this idea that things have often crossed seas and oceans.
So, Alan, it was more than just your love of travel, say, that got you there, it sounds like. But it is quite fascinating. If we look at intercontinental drift, continental drift, it makes sense. I mean, you can look at a map of the globe and you can see how continents separated. It's very easy to see and it makes common sense. But I want to go back to, biogeography where... Let's go back to Darwin and what he posited were the reasons for finding similar species, separated by an ocean.
Well, it's interesting that if you go back to Darwin, Darwin was definitely a believer, sort of a great believer, in the importance of ocean crossings. So, he looked at the distribution, or he observed that there are all these species on remote islands, and many of them are volcanic islands that have never been connected to the mainland. So from that, he concluded that a lot of things must have crossed wide expanses of ocean to colonize these islands. So he was a great believer in that. In fact, it was a kind of a key part of his argument for evolution. It wasn't that things were separately created on remote islands. It was that creatures, plants, and animals had gotten from continents to those islands by crossing oceans. So he was a big believer in that. And the field of biogeography, the study where things are and how they got there, it's kind of gone through a bunch of different sort of views. So Darwin was a great believer in these ocean crossings, but then later people started thinking, well, that's really impossible, and they started hypothesizing all these different land bridges that were now sunken below the ocean, even to places like Hawaii, for which there's really no geological evidence.
Even upon which humans were walked, at least that theory holds something, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a certain truth to it, too. So, even now we believe that humans, for example, crossed from Asia into North America by going, literally walking over the Bering Land Bridge. So it's not as if we don't believe in land bridges at all anymore, but there was a phase when people were just erecting these land bridges all over the place to explain all these weird distributions.
But Darwin didn't just...
So that was kind of one phase in the history of biogeography.
And Darwin didn't just conjecture or come up with these different ideas. He took large numbers of different types of plant seeds and soaked them in brine and salt water, and this whole idea that there were moving islands of plant life going across these oceans. So he actually had data backing up some of this.
Right. Yeah, that was a key part of the Origin of Species, actually, that he did these experiments showing that plant seeds could actually survive being immersed in seawater for weeks or even months. So he actually put them in jars or tubs of seawater and left them in there for a long time and then put them in the ground to see if they would germinate, and a lot of them did germinate. So that was kind of an experiment indicating that this was at least possible, that plant seeds could be in the ocean for a long time, say literally floating in the water or on a small raft or something like a natural raft, and that once they made it across the ocean, they could still germinate.
Okay. So current thinking by different groups are that the advocates of intelligent design believe that the whole Darwinian worldview is just a delusion. There are monkeys on both sides of the Atlantic because God created monkeys in all lands. And then there's the older science, which talk about the plates moving, talking about these land masses that as the supercontinents broke up, they took this ride on these land masses, and now you're saying that there's something else. Can you tell us your view?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll make a very brief comment about the creationism first, which the creationist argument, which is that that argument actually still exists. And in fact, there's been some recent kind of backlash against what the scientists are saying about these situations where things are found on opposite sides of an ocean. You know, creationists are saying that is because of separate creation. So I'm not going to really get into that. I'll just sort of say that there's overwhelming evidence that that's not the case from all kinds of different areas. But, so then there's been this more recent scientific view starting in the 60s, but it really gathered steam in the 70s and 80s, that all these weird distributions where related species are separated from each other by oceans, that was mostly due to continental drift, that, you know, for instance, there was this supercontinent of Gondwana on which all these different plants and animals were living, and when that supercontinent broke up through continental drift, it just carried the different species with them, and that's why you now see related species, for instance, in South America and Africa, like monkeys in Africa and monkeys in South America. What my book is about, and really it's not, I wouldn't say this isn't my idea, it's something that's been kind of gathering steam in this field of biogeography for about the last 20 years, is that things have actually crossed oceans on their own by natural rafts or by being blown on storm winds for small things like insects, or floating in the ocean for things like plant seeds. That really accounts for a lot more of these weird distributions than biologists have thought. So that's kind of where we're at now, that we're, in a way, we're going back to Darwin, because we were in this period where people were trying to explain almost everything by continental drift. And now we're finding, whoa, it looks like Darwin was actually, you know, more right than we had thought.
Now, Alan, it makes all kinds of sense that plant seeds can drift in the wind, in the water, animals less so. But it is very plausible to me that, I mean, if you think about the sheer force of a hurricane, for example, what kinds of things? I mean, hurricanes gather up, you know, entire buildings in their force. And so why not animals and transporting them across? I mean, how does it happen, you know, outside of storm cycles?
Well,
and what are the biggest animals that can be gathered up?
Yeah, well, that's actually a really good point. And I think most biogeographers would say that, in fact, storms are really important. And, for instance, you know, it could be that the reason monkeys were able to cross the Atlantic was because they got blown by storms. Well, they were on a natural raft of some sort, like a raft of earth and vegetation. But then that raft was pushed along partly by storm winds. And the same argument has been made for insects crossing oceans, too, that it makes it a lot easier if they can get blown across really quickly by storm winds. And as far as kind of a limit to what might be able to cross an ocean, I would say there's hardly anything for which I'd say it's totally impossible for that to happen. I mean, you could imagine even a large mammal like a rhino or an elephant, you know, possibly could hitch a ride on one of these, on a really large raft of vegetation. Now, there's no evidence that that's actually happened for rhinos or elephants, but theoretically it at least seems possible.
How big is the biggest, land mass that's just floating? As I mean, anyone who's been in the ocean has seen these huge pieces of driftwood. But in terms of little, you know, pieces of land that break off, or whatever it is, marine life and vegetation that break off, what's the biggest that has been found?
I don't think I could. I don't think I know exactly what the maximum is, but just to give an example, there was a case where people saw a floating island off the east coast of North America, and I don't remember exactly how large it was. I think it was something on the order of 900 square feet in area, and the striking thing about it was that it actually had trees intact on it, growing on it, and some of them were 30 feet tall. So, you know, it's a pretty substantial raft. And I know that there are other examples of even much larger rafts, but that's kind of one that I sort of know the details of. And the interesting thing about that particular case is that the same raft was spotted more than 1,000 miles away and sort of on its way to Europe, although I don't know if it ever actually made land in Europe. But it's kind of a striking case because people actually observed it at two points more than 1,000 miles apart in the Atlantic.
I wonder how much plastic was weaved into that floating island.
Actually, that case was before the invention of plastic, so... But I'm sure nowadays there's probably a lot of plastic that gets pushed around like
sturdier
that.
Sturdier islands. Yeah. Alan, I wanted to ask you, you know, to me the evolution is, you know, life forms that change, adopt, that, you know, they mutate over time. But in reading your book, evolution's also about life forms that travel on amazing journeys. And if a species has to travel to propagate, what does this say for humans and outer space?
Let's see. I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Are you asking
for a species to evolve? Do they have to travel? I mean, it seems like that helps to ensure that a species will continue. And does that say anything for us for space exploration?
Actually, that is a really interesting and big question. It's clearly not the case that things have to do that to survive. So there's certainly many things that have, you know, never, many groups that have never made one of these long ocean journeys, and, you know, they're still persisting in place, or they've persisted in place for many millions of years. So it's certainly not necessary. But it is probably the case that certain things, because they have crossed oceans, have then become much more successful in the sense of giving rise to many more species than they would have if they hadn't crossed an ocean. And I don't know if I want to get into the future of humanity related to space travel, but you can certainly make that analogy that, you know, the survival of humans might be enhanced if we can colonize some other world, but
I'll tell you what happened, Alan. Was it Lynn and I, our second guest, quotes Ray Kurzweil in that the singularity is near, and it's our next guest is just very, very heavy topic. So for some reason, I just started thinking about space travel.
It is related.
Why not?
Our guest is Alan de Quiros. He's the author of The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shaped the History of Life. And Alan, I guess I'm interested, you know, maybe branching off like John just was trying to do, you know, what are the theories that are less plausible that would explain everything we've talked about so far makes all kinds of common sense to me, and it sounds logical. But what about things that are a little more far-flung, like even quantum physics and the fact that thought is actually matter and matter can travel? What about things like that you've encountered in your study? That's a little bit beyond.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit beyond certainly beyond what I discuss in the book.
Okay.
Lynn and I are in an unusual mood this morning.
Well,
I don't know how this happened, Lynn.
I think it's the snow. It snowed about a foot here last night, Alan. Yeah. It makes us do crazy things.
Yeah.
Well, and maybe it's this theory that I heard of many years ago, maybe a decade ago, and it's almost as though I dreamt it up because I've asked for confirmation on it from a number of scientists and no one can actually do that. But it's called something like the 100th monkey theory, and it's about the evolution of behaviors among species that are on separate continents, entirely separate, you know, islands that are really hard to explain. And so that would lend itself to the argument or the theory of quantum physics, which would say that it's all part of this collective consciousness.
Oh, you mean that things that are separated are doing something so similar that it seems like there must be some kind of a thought connection between them? Or
exactly.
I'm actually familiar with that one. I think I can describe this in less than a minute. I'm going to take a shot at this anyway. There's this monkey in Asia that always eats its sweet potatoes. Oh, there's this group of monkeys in Asia that always eat their sweet potatoes the same way. And all of a sudden, the head monkey decides that he's going to wash his sweet potatoes in salt water, and then he's going to eat them. That's never, ever
right.
been done before. So he does that, and then the rest of the tribe, they start doing it. And then 2 days later, about 10,000 miles away, monkeys all of a sudden are washing their sweet potatoes in salt water, and they're 10,000 miles away, and they've never done this before in their lives either. It's like, you know, this single organism.
Right. Yeah, I guess I'm skeptical enough that I would ascribe that to a coincidence. So, although, I mean, its coincidence may be based on the evolution of a particular kind of brain in monkeys. So, you know, obviously most animals are probably completely incapable of making that leap to, oh, we should wash this stuff off of our food. And, you know, monkeys have the sort of brain where different populations could come up with that separately. I don't think it really requires that there's necessarily literally some kind of connection between the consciousness of different populations. I think it's more like monkeys in different places have a tendency to think alike, so to speak.
Right. Well, you've had some really good reviews of your book. Could I be safe in assuming that you will not be the keynote speaker at the Intelligent Design Convention this year?
Yeah, I think that's a safe bet, unless they, you know, want to put me up there to shoot me down or something.
Yeah, I understand that they have a website that basically the gist of it is there's two monkeys on a raft with their arms spread out like Kate Winslet and Leo DiCaprio on the Titanic, and there's a sign that says Brazil or bust, Brazil or bust.
Yeah, so, I mean, I kind of alluded to this sort of thing earlier, that there's been this kind of reaction from creationists about this new emphasis on ocean crossings among biologists. So what the creationists are saying is, look at this stuff. It's completely ridiculous. Monkeys couldn't possibly have crossed the Atlantic. So from that, they're trying to make this argument that it must have been, you know, separate creation of monkeys in the old world and the new. And again, I don't really want to get into the details of why I don't believe that, but probably in the simplest sense, just that if you look at things like morphology and DNA, and especially DNA sequences, it's really clear that old world and new world monkeys are part of the same group, that they're closely related in an evolutionary sense. So, you know, if you believe in evolution at all, then you have to have some explanation for this. Now, I know this is not going to convince the creationists, but I just wanted to put that out there.
Right, right. You know, I wanted to ask you also, Alan, what does the sequencing of DNA and genomic structure, what is it also doing to forward your theory? I mean, what more are we able to learn, and what is ahead, do you think?
Well, I think the key thing really has to do with what's called a molecular clock. So, and again, to apply it to the case of monkeys, so you're looking at DNA sequences of old world monkeys and new world monkeys, and based on the genetic differences between them, you can tell at least roughly when those two lineages split off from each other. Right. So
right.
In a simplistic sense, you can say, you know, how old is the monkey group as a whole? And from that information, you can say in that particular case that monkeys are too young of a group to have been affected by the opening of the Atlantic Ocean. So and that's the sort of information that's been really critical in this kind of revival of the idea of oceanic dispersal, of things crossing oceans. So, so really what it boils down to is we now have a lot more information on timing, on sort of when things happened in the course of the history of life. And that's really been critical in this whole kind of, pardon the pun, sea change in biogeography. So that's really what's driving it. And I think that's going to continue to be the case, that as we get more and more information about timing. Not necessarily that it's going to overwhelmingly support the idea that things have crossed oceans, but that it's just going to be a big part of studying biogeography, that we're going to have all this new information on when things happened.
So when you look at the molecular clock of the monkeys in the various locations, they weren't around when the continents were drifting and that sort of thing, but they were around way before the Vikings were making their crossing. So it's not like they jumped on a Viking boat. They had to do something in between. So that's basically what you're saying.
Right. And now there are something like 130 or so species of monkeys in the New World that all descended from this single ancestor that crossed the ocean. So it's pretty clear that, you know, 130 species couldn't have, I mean, this is a different sort of argument, but it's pretty clear that 130 species could not have evolved after humans brought something across the Atlantic. There clearly hasn't been enough time for that to happen. So it's clearly something that happened in the distant past, and the latest estimates are that it probably happened between about 30 and 40 million years ago.
Wanted to also mention, Alan, a point you make in the book is these transoceanic voyages sometimes would happen once every 50 million years or something to ensure species was distributed. Once in 50 million years isn't a lot. I think of, for some reason, I thought of, you know, when you go to the airport and you've just been in a foreign land and they're checking your shoes for mud, what you might be transporting back, and just how accelerated the transportation has become with global travel and, you know, that sort of thing. How does that all tie into, I guess it, you enter into a conversation about invasive species and all kinds of things.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. And so when I've actually brought this subject up of, you know, how important it's been in the history of life that things have crossed oceans naturally, one reaction that people have is that, oh, well, maybe that means that humans introducing species all over the world is not really a big deal because it's just the same thing that's been going on for hundreds of millions of years anyway. And, yeah, my reaction to that would be that, well, that's sort of true, but it's there's a huge difference in both how frequently we're moving things across oceans compared to what happens naturally. So, for instance, there have probably been more species introduced by humans to Hawaii in the last, you know, several hundred years than the number that had gotten there on their own in the entire, you know, 5 million year history of the islands. Actually, the history goes back even beyond that because there were Hawaiian islands before the current ones. But anyway, so it's an entirely different sort of degree of things crossing oceans. And also, humans are bringing things across oceans that probably would almost never make it on their own. Things like pigs and goats. So pigs and goats have been transported all over the world, and rats too.
You don't think it was in the eye of the storm, the hurricane?
What's that? Oh yeah. And so anyway, pigs and goats are things that are actually not very good at crossing sea saltwater barriers on their own. So These things, people are, you know, moving them all over the place. They're doing terrible damage to island faunas, for instance. And that's a very unnatural thing because those sorts of animals really are not very good at crossing seas on their own.
Well, Alan, we have run out of time, but we want to thank you for joining us this morning.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. And again, it's The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shaped the History of Life.
Yes. And so, Alan, thanks for joining us.
Okay.
We'll be back after these messages for
Cool. Thanks a lot for having me.
Oh, very welcome. For today's Cool Story, you're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
KPCW presents Park City Stories, hosted by Leslie Thatcher and heard on Friday throughout the day. Supported by Sea2Ski, property management and concierge service provider for Park City's vacation homeowners. Sea2SkiProperties.com.
Park City Ski Boot, dedicated to the individual performance ski boot fit. 1100 Iron Horse Drive, parkcityskiboot.com. And Alan Schoenberger Ski Studio, helping Park City learn to ski one turn at a time. 435-640-3103, skistudiopc.com.
Hi, this is Summer Schlopey, swimmer, runner, and mom of two kids in the Park City School District. Registration is open for the 5th annual Running with Ed. It's Park City's celebration of education. Have your friends and hi, this is Summer Schlopey, swimmer, runner, and mom of two kids in the Park City School District. Registration is open for the 5th annual Running with Ed. It's Park City's celebration of education. Have your friends and family sign up before January 31st and receive $25 off your team registration. New this year, 6, 7, and even 10-person teams are available. Join the race that's a party and raises money for our teachers and students. All proceeds benefit Park City Education Foundation, a nonprofit organization.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. We just got a message that 224 is, for some reason, backed up. It's the southbound into town direction. It's bumper to bumper for no apparent reason. It's backed up all the way to I-80 on-ramp, or off-ramp, I guess, the exit from I-80 onto 224. So I-80 is clear itself. 224 is slow going into town from the junction. So we just got a message also that our next guest, Jason Silva, is sick and he canceled last minute. So we're going to take the next 20 minutes or so and rebroadcast a previous interview we did with Eric Schlosser. Now he's the famed author of Fast Food Nation, but he came out with a book last fall, Command and Control. It's about nuclear bombs and how they must be handled with proper care, especially in this country, but that's not always the case, mentioning harrowing mishaps in the history of the American atomic arsenal. Schlosser singles out one for detailed dramatization. It's about the explosion in 1980 of a Titan II missile. He talks with John and me. Oh, it was a couple months ago. We're going to rebroadcast that interview now. Here's Eric Schlosser.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Eric, at the crux of your book, you recount in really blow by blow, I mean, edge of your seat kind of detail, an incident in Damascus involving the release of weapons of mass destruction. Now, ironically, you're not talking about Damascus, Syria. You're talking Damascus, Arkansas, home of the Titan II missile complex. So, and also you're referring to an incident that happened about 33 years ago involving a socket wrench. Tell us about that.
Well, there was a repairman doing routine maintenance on a Titan II missile in a silo in Damascus, Arkansas. And he had to put a socket on his wrench in order to loosen a fuel cap, pressure cap. Routine thing, happened all the time. The socket fell off the wrench. It hit the work platform he was standing on. Bounced. He reached out for it, missed it, and it fell between this really narrow gap in between the platform and the missile. He was standing near the top of the missile. The socket fell about 70 feet, ricocheted off part of the silo, hit the missile, pierced the skin of the missile, and cut a hole in it, releasing thousands of gallons of rocket fuel into the silo. Very toxic, very lethal, very explosive. Rocket fuel. Now, I talked to other repairmen. You could drop that socket 1,000 times from that platform trying to hit the missile.
Right.
And never achieve it. So it was a completely freak accident, but it created a very dangerous situation. This was the largest intercontinental ballistic missile the United States ever built, and on top of it was the most powerful nuclear warhead the United States ever put on a missile. That warhead had an explosive force of 9 megatons. And what that means is it was 3 times more powerful than all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War, including both atomic bombs. And the Air Force didn't know what to do as soon as this accident happened because nothing like it had ever happened before.
So crisis was somehow averted. I mean, not crisis wasn't really averted, but there wasn't mass destruction. And, you know, I'm wondering, did people know about it? You know, you wrote that motorists passing by didn't even know it occurred. Did the government keep it, you know, hush hush?
No, people knew about it. There was a massive explosion, and the whole area was evacuated. And flames shot, it's not clear, but at least 1,000 feet into the air. And the nuclear warhead was lost for some time, and people were injured. The reason that we don't remember it is it was a big news story for about a day.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force was adamant that there was no possibility that this warhead could have detonated. And at the time, President Carter was up for re-election against Ronald Reagan. The hostages were being held in Iran. And this was a news story that lasted about a day.
Hmm.
But through my reporting and through my research, it's apparent now that warhead could, in fact, have detonated. And if it had detonated, it would have destroyed most of the state of Arkansas and sent lethal radioactive fallout up the eastern coast of the United States. And it's one of those things that, you know, the course of history would have changed.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton was the governor at the time. He was in Hot Springs, not all that far away. Vice President Mondale was in Arkansas that day.
Mm.
Chelsea Clinton was a little one-year-old baby. And, you know, it's remarkable that that ended well.
It's an amazing story, and the way you wrote it with all the detail and talking about the volatility of the fuels when they mix and those sorts of things. I mean, there are other stories, too, and many books chronicling the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the Cold War have been written by those in charge, the people with the power, president,
yeah.
Secretary of State. But your book is refreshingly different. It is written from the perspective of the service person who
yeah.
risks their lives to avert these types of disasters. What prompted you to write the book this way?
You know, I was spending time with the Air Force after I wrote Fast Food Nation, and an officer I was spending time with told me the story of the Damascus accident, and I just thought it was an unbelievable story. I couldn't believe I'd never heard about it, but the details of it were extraordinary. So I set out to track down some of the people who were there, and I spent time with them, and I was struck by the incredible personal courage of the people who were trying to prevent a nuclear catastrophe. But even beyond that, throughout the Cold War, and I think we've done a disservice to many of these servicemen. You know, in the films, the Strategic Air Command officers, and they're always depicted as these right-wing, crazy warmongers. There were thousands of people who served, who risked their lives, sometimes lost them, and sacrificed a great deal in their personal life in order to prevent nuclear catastrophes like this one and in order to prevent a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And I thought their stories were fascinating. There have been many, many books written on nuclear weapons that look at Oppenheimer and Teller and the famous Manhattan Project scientists. But what was interesting to me was the day-in, day-out management of our nuclear weapons by the people who handled them every day, whether they were bomber pilots, bomber crew members, nuclear weapon repairmen, nuclear weapon designers. One of the people I profile in the book is a bomb squad technician whose job it was, if there was a broken arrow, a serious nuclear weapons accident, it's his job to go over to a damaged nuclear weapon and defuse it. Now, that takes some nerve to do.
It sure does. How many broken arrows have occurred in the last 30 years?
Well, you know, the official list of broken arrows put out by the Department of Defense lists 32 serious accidents that threaten the public involving a nuclear weapon. But when you look more closely at that list, you know, some of those accidents did not involve a fully assembled nuclear weapon and posed no risk whatsoever of a detonation, whereas through the Freedom of Information Act and through interviews with weapons scientists from the big weapons laboratories, there were many, many more accidents than 32 in which a weapon could have detonated, an American weapon detonating accidentally on American soil. Now, the Damascus accident I wrote about at greatest length because so many of the bigger themes of the book are evident in the story, and it's also, I think, a great story. But I talk about other accidents in the book that could have led to detonations. And sometimes, you know, a very simple, mundane thing, not a plane crash or a missile, you know, fire, could set off a weapon. A short circuit inside the weapon. You know, improperly unloading a weapon from an aircraft could arm it. And once the weapon's armed, if you drop it from, you know, 5 or 6 feet, it could conceivably detonate. And those things happened a lot. There's no way to conclusively say how many serious nuclear weapons accidents or incidents we had. There was one document that I got from the Sandia National Laboratory, and it mentioned 1,200 nuclear weapons involved in accidents from, I think, 1950 to 1968.
Wow.
So a lot. We had a number of serious close calls.
We're speaking with Eric Schlosser, who has written a fascinating wake-up call titled Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusions of Safety.
Now, Eric, you also, I mean, there are many anecdotes in the story. Another one that I recalled is an atomic bomb in South Carolina that's dropped without a detonating device in this family's backyard. And their doctor who treats them tells about it.
Yeah. You know, that was one of the accidents that could not have led to a detonation because the weapon wasn't fully assembled, but it sure scared the hell out of the family.
Oh, yeah.
They were just at their house in the suburbs, and suddenly there was a massive explosion in their yard, and it dug a huge crater, and none of them were seriously hurt. You know, windows were blown out of their house. Their brand new car was destroyed, but it turned out that there had been an Air Force plane flying overhead. There were problems with the weapon being properly locked into the plane, and it fell, and the high explosives in the weapon detonated. But it was also a pretty scary story for one of the crew members of the plane, because a light had come on in the plane saying that the weapon wasn't properly secured. He was ordered to go into the bomb bay of the plane, which was flying at, I don't know, 10,000 feet, 11,000 feet, 15,000 feet. And he had to climb into the bomb bay to make sure that the weapon was properly attached. While he was leaning on the weapon and looking to see if it was properly attached, and this sounds like something out of Strangelove, the weapon fell from its mounting, hit the bomb bay doors, and he fell with it. He was able to grab onto something in the bomb bay just as those doors broke and the weapon fell. So he was left dangling, holding on, as beneath his feet, the South Carolina rural countryside went past at, you know, 10 or 15,000 feet. He was able to climb back into the plane. But this is just one more incident that shows it's very complicated to maintain control of any of these technologies. Accidents happen, people make mistakes, but the margin of error with nuclear weapons is very, very small.
That's right. Were you able to talk to that pilot?
No, I never was.
Yeah.
I never was. I got his account through the accident report and through contemporary news reports on it. This was another nuclear weapons accident that was very difficult to hide because suddenly there's a huge explosion in this family's yard, and they were taken to the hospital, and suddenly there were guys in radiation suits wandering around their property. So, you know, that's an instance in which the military truthfully said, they said in that incident, there was never any chance that the weapon would detonate, and they were right. But there were other times they said there was no chance of the weapon detonating when they weren't being entirely truthful.
Right. Now, as John says, you talk to a lot of people in researching this book, and I just want to say your book is about 500 pages and then another 150 pages of notes and acknowledgments, and it's really a just staggering amount of work that you did here. And so I'm wondering, in the work and in the research, did you find that you were pleased to see that since Damascus happened, you know, 33 years ago, that things have gotten safer? Or were you dismayed? I'm thinking may have been your finding that that this stuff still goes on, needless accidents.
You know, one quick comment on those notes. The notes are extensive, and readers don't have to feel obligated to look through them, but I felt it was important not to rely on unnamed sources,
right,
not to have people accept some of these incredible assertions, you know, on, you know, just take it from me. But because there's been so much secrecy, because the government has tried so hard to keep this information away from the public, I felt like my work should be transparent. And people, readers, should be able to see exactly where the information came from and track it down for themselves. You know, I came away having met so many of these officers, weapons designers. I came away in one way encouraged by the patriotism of these people, by their personal courage, by their very sincere effort to devoting their lives to preventing these accidents and to preventing nuclear war. So, you know, I didn't meet any crazy warmongering generals who wanted to nuke the Soviets. I found a lot of patriotic, hardworking people for whom I have enormous admiration, and I write about that in the book. But I did come away concerned still to this day about the management of our nuclear weapons. The weapons themselves are much safer. I write about how modern nuclear weapon safety devices have been invented. And so the weapons themselves are safer, but it's still a real challenge. I mean, just this summer, two of our three strategic missile wings have been cited for safety violations. The largest storage facility for nuclear weapons that the Air Force runs, everyone who worked in that squadron was decertified, basically taken off the job a few years ago for safety violations. Our weapons are aging. Our land-based missiles were deployed in the 1970s, which means many of them are close to 40 years old. A lot of the infrastructure, the cables, the equipment that controls them is 30, 40 years old. And we can argue about should we have nuclear weapons or how many should we have, but having done the research I've done, if we're going to have them, we should spare no expense in how we manage them. We should spare no expense and how we compensate the people who oversee them, and we need to make sure that they're very well trained and very highly motivated. And so I still have concerns about the system.
Eric, there seems to be a tremendous amount of talk today about terrorism, and there's certainly too much talk today about the Kardashians,
yeah,
but there's not a lot of people talking about the dangers of nuclear weapons. Why is that?
Well, one of the great miraculous events of history was the collapse of the Soviet Union without a third world war. When I was growing up, I'm 54, when I was growing up, it was inconceivable that the Soviet Union would vanish from the earth, that the Berlin Wall would come down, that Germany would be reunited without a world war, without thousands or even millions of people dying for that to happen. And most people thought those things would never happen. The Berlin Wall was a permanent fixture of the European landscape. And one of the things that happened is there was so much jubilation and so much joy at these wonderful things happening. People forgot that these nuclear weapons are still out there, thousands of them, ready to be used in the United States, in Russia today, in China. And now that we're, you know, 20-plus years on from the collapse of the Soviet Union, There's an entire generation that has no knowledge of nuclear weapons.
Is this one of the reasons?
Remember the existential threat and dread that so many people felt in the Cold War, literally, the thought that a war might come any day that could destroy all of mankind. Half the American population either wasn't born or were small children when the Soviet Union collapsed. So there's a lack of memory. There's a lack of awareness of these issues. And I think, you know, global warming and nuclear weapons are the two greatest threats that this country faces. And we need to have much more discussion, much more awareness, and much more debate, not only about our nuclear arsenal and its potential problems, but also about how to reduce the number of nuclear weapons throughout the world. It's just of urgent importance.
And that was our guest, Eric Schlosser, the author of Command and Control. Want to thank him. That was actually an interview that we rebroadcast today because our guest, Jason Silva, unfortunately turned up to be ill this morning. Jason Silva is the director of Brain Games. It's on the National Geographic Channel, and he's a fascinating guy, so we hope that he overcomes his sudden illness and he can join us perhaps next week. But in the meantime, fascinating to rebroadcast that interview with Eric Schlosser. Fascinating book and interesting guy.
And we also want to thank our first guest, Alan Decatos, who's the author of Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shaped the History of Life. Of course, we want to thank our sponsor, San Francisco Design, Prudential Real Estate, Peak Art and Frame, and our producer, Beth Fratkin, for all of her help. We're going to go to some messages. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
The Local View is on the air today from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. This is Randy Barton. I'll be your host. It's 30th day of January, a Thursday. Heber Valley Tourism at 4:15. Stacy Conklin, Stacy's Groceries at 5:15. And Seedless, my musical guests at 5:45. Local news, national news, international headlines, sponsored by CNS Creative Services, Silver King Coffee, Mercer Automotive, and Molly Bloom's Gastro Pub.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week we're talking to Nigella Lawson about her early years working in Italy.
I'd said I will do absolutely anything except clean restrooms, and consequently got a job as a chambermaid where, of course, my job was to clean restrooms.
Join us. That's The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Join KPCW every Sunday morning at 9 for The Splendid Table, sponsored by the River Horse on Main.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We want to thank everyone for joining us this morning. Lynn, you know, the Giving a Bleep preview is tonight. That's opening night.
Oh, what a hilarious play. I saw it last year. And, of course, it's rewritten this year. But what
yes,
a great play.
And the entire cast from Giving a Bleep will be on Fun Friday tomorrow, along with Chef Scott with Big Game Snacks.
Very good. Yes, that's tomorrow, Fun Friday, 9 a.m. I want to thank you for listening to Cool Science Radio. You're listening to KPCW Park City. We'll go to news in just a moment here. Let's take a little updated look at the weather. Of course, 100% chance of snow today. It's not snowing right now, but that means that we could have some snow back on the way. High today, 33 degrees. It's 32 degrees right now. Tonight's low 17 degrees, and snow chance decreases throughout the afternoon. Tonight's chance 70% of more snow accumulation, and then tomorrow that chance goes down to 30%, but we're still expected to get a couple more inches today. So we like to have that white stuff. Looks like it's going to be unsettled until Sunday, when it will be clear, mostly sunny.